Chapter 18. Adams hovered the Robinson helicopter above Mount Forel, then used the remote speaker to send out the sound of an air horn. He waited a few minutes, then caught sight of a green glowing light from below. Flying a short distance toward the light, he sounded the air horn again to give Cabrillo warning to move away from the landing pad. Then he set the helicopter down on the snow. Once the rotor blade had stopped spinning, he climbed out.
"Mr. Chairman," he said as Cabrillo walked over, "I'm glad I found you. It's as black as a sack of licorice out here."
"Everyone get out of Iceland safely?"
"It all went according to plan," Adams said.
"That's one bright spot," Cabrillo said. "Now, how are we for weight?"
"With the two of us aboard and fuel, we still have a few hundred pounds left over. Why do you ask?"
"We have another passenger," Cabrillo said.
"Who?"
"A civilian who was shot," Cabrillo told him.
"I think it was just a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time." "Is he dead or alive?"
"I'm not sure, but it doesn't look good," Cabrillo said, pointing toward the entrance to the cave.
"Go into the cave, then carry him out to the helicopter. I'll move the snowcat over and begin refueling."
Adams nodded and started walking up the hill. At the entrance, he stopped and stared north. Along the horizon, blue and green lights flickered and danced like wispy sheets of fabric illuminated by dancing light. The plasma that comprised the northern lights was putting on a show, and Adams felt a chill from the unnatural scene. Turning on his heels, he entered the cave. Cabrillo climbed into the snowcat and drove it over to the helicopter. He began to transfer the fuel using a hand-cranked pump on the top of the spare tank. He was just finishing filling the Robinson's second tank when Adams appeared through the darkness carrying Ackerman, who was still inside the sleeping bag. Carefully placing the archaeologist into the rear seat, he attached a seat belt, then walked around to Cabrillo.
"I've got some bottles of octane booster that need to be added," he said.
"Give them to me and I'll put them in. I want you to get Huxley on the radio and ask her if there's anything we can do for our passenger. Explain that he has a serious bullet wound and he's lost a lot of blood." Adams nodded, then reached into a storage compartment and removed the two bottles of octane booster and handed them to Cabrillo. Then he climbed into the pilot's seat and turned on the radio. He climbed back out once he had completed the call, then reached back into the storage compartment and retrieved a collapsible snow shovel. As Cabrillo finished the refueling, Adams began shoveling snow into Ackerman's sleeping bag.
"She said to ice him down and slow his heartbeat," Adams said as Cabrillo walked over, "to induce hypothermia and put him into a suspended state."
"How long until we reach the Oregon?" Cabrillo asked.
"They were steaming at full speed when I took off," Adams noted. "So that'll shave some time off the return trip. If I had to guess, I'd estimate about an hour."
Cabrillo nodded and brushed some snow from his eyebrows.
"I'll move the snowcat," he said. "You fire this up and get everything to operating temperatures."
"Got it."
4 minutes later, Cabrillo climbed into the passenger seat of the idling helicopter. A few seconds more, and Adams engaged the clutch and set the rotor blade spinning, and a minute after that, he lifted the helicopter from the snow. Aboard the Oregon, Hanley was working on the plan for the assault on the Akbar. Off to one side of the control room, Eddie Seng was sketching out notes on a yellow pad. Eric Stone walked over to where Hanley was seated and pointed at the large monitor on the wall. The image showed Greenland's coastline, the location of the Akbar, and the course the Oregon was steaming.
"Sir," he said, pointing, "the Akbar has not moved in 15 minutes. The same, however, cannot be said for the meteorite. If the signal from the sand is correct, it's moving farther away."
"That doesn't make any sense," Hanley noted. "Could we be receiving a false reading?"
Stone nodded affirmatively.
"With the northern lights acting up and the curvature of the earth this far north, we could be getting a skip in signals off the ionosphere."
"How long until we reach the Akbar?" Hanley asked.
"We were about an hour away," Stone said. Now that she's stopped, it shaves 10 minutes or so off that estimate.
Eddie, Hanley asked, can you have your men ready earlier?
Sure, Singh said. The first man aboard does most of the work. Once he sprays the paralytic agent into the air duct and the bad guys go to sleep, the rest is just mopping up and securing the ship.
Stone had walked back to his chair. He was studying a radio frequency graph that showed signal strengths on the various bands.
We're picking up something down low, he said.
See if you can tune it in, Hanley ordered.
Stone fiddled with a dial, then pushed a button on the console to boost the receiving strength. Then he flicked on the speaker.
Portland, Salem Bend, a voice said. Okay to transmit.
On the Akbar, the prisoner had managed to free his hands again, and his legs. Listening at the door of his cabin, he'd heard nothing. So he'd cracked the door and peered out. There was no one in the hall. He'd slowly searched the ship from stem to stern and found it empty. Then he had tugged off his latex mask. He'd made his way to the pilot house and had reached for the radio.
Portland, Salem Bend, he repeated. Okay to transmit.
On the Oregon, Hanley reached for the microphone to answer.
This is Oregon. Identify. 6-11-59.
Murph, Hanley asked. What are you doing on the radio?
That was a bold plan, Adams said as he flew the helicopter through the black sky, using a double for the Emir of Qatar.
We've known Al-Khalifa was planning to move on the Emir for some time, Cabrillo said, and the Emir went along with our little operation. He wants Al-Khalifa out of the picture as much as we do.
You eaten lately? Adams asked.
I brought some sandwiches and cookies plus some milk. They're in a bag on the rear seat.
Cabrillo nodded and reached back onto the seat next to Ackerman. He opened a padded cooler bag and removed a sandwich.
Do you have any coffee?
A pilot without coffee? Adams said lightly. That's like a fisherman without worms.
There's a thermos on the floor back there. It's my special Italian roast blend.
Cabrillo retrieved the thermos and poured a cup. He took a couple of sips, then placed the cup on the floor by his feet and took a bite of the sandwich.
So it was planned all along to have the fake Emir kidnapped?
Adams asked.
Nope,
Cabrillo said. We figured we could grab Al-Khalifa before he made his move. The one bright spot is that we're certain Al-Khalifa has no plans to kill the Emir. He just wants him to abdicate the throne in favor of the Al-Khalifa clan. Our man should be as safe as a cow at a vegetarian's conference as long as he's not found out as a fake. Cabrillo ate another third of the sandwich.
Sir, Adams said, can I ask you something?
Sure,
Cabrillo said, taking the last bite of sandwich and reaching for the coffee.
What the hell were you doing in Greenland? And who exactly is that guy that's near death on the back of my helicopter?
Al-Khalifa and his men took off,
Murphy said.
I'm the only one left on board, as far as I can tell.
That doesn't make any sense, Hanley said. Is the helicopter still on board?
I saw it sitting on the rear deck,
Murphy said. And you walked the entire yacht?
Yep. It's as if they never existed.
Hold on,
Hanley said, turning to Stone. 38 minutes, sir, Stone said to the unasked question.
Murph, Hanley said, we'll be there in a half hour. See what you can dig up before we arrive.
Will do,
Murphy said.
We'll be there soon, Hanley said, and then we can figure this all out.
I received a call from our contact at the CIA, Cabrillo said. When we were in Reykjavik, Echelon intercepted an email pertaining to a meteorite comprised of iridium. The CIA was concerned about it falling into the wrong hands, so they asked me to fly over and secure it.
That gentleman, he said, motioning to the rear, is the man that discovered it.
He dug it out of the cave?
Not exactly, Cabrillo said.
You didn't have a chance to take the tour. There's a large shrine that was built on a shaft above the one you were in, very elaborate. Someone long ago must have unearthed the meteorite and fancied it as a religious or spiritual artifact. The guy in back is an archaeologist who somehow found a clue and tracked down the site. Adams adjusted his flight controls, then spoke into his headset.
Oregon, this is Air One. We're 20 minutes out.
After receiving a reply from Stone in the control room, he continued.
The whole thing seems odd. Even if the meteorite has historical value, I don't see rival archaeologists killing each other over a find. They probably dream about doing that, but I've never heard about an instance.
Right now, Cabrillo said, it looks like Al-Khalifa and the Hamadi group intercepted the email and recovered the meteorite for the iridium. They must want to construct a dirty bomb with the material.
And if that's the case, Adams said, then they must already have a working bomb of some sort to use as the catalyst. Otherwise, they have a fuel and no fire.
My thoughts exactly.
Then, after our team recovers the meteorite, we still need to locate the mother bomb.
Once we have Al-Khalifa, Cabrillo said, we'll make him give up the location of the weapon. Then a crew can be sent to disable it, and we'll be through. Cabrillo didn't know it yet, but Al-Khalifa was on the bottom of the ocean, right next to a series of geothermal vents.